Hi everyone. Our last episode came out the same day as the horrific Supreme Court ruling for Roe versus Wade last week. So, we're just going to do a quick thing at the beginning here for what we can do, because what are we going to do?
All right, let's do it.
Okay, so I heard about this movement talking about the horribleness of not having the right to be able to choose whether or not your life is changed inalterably or ended by not having an abortion through the My Favorite Murder thing. Who heard it from the Earbuds Podcast Collective? Some places to donate, or if you want to volunteer time, you can go to abortionfunds.org, which is the National Network for Abortion Funds. Abortion funds form a network of over 90 grassroots organizations that directly support people to get the abortions they want and need. Abortion funds are autonomous in their structures and policies, so that's good. Sorry, this is super hard for me to record. You can become a member of the network of abortion funds to help people get through this. You could join by going to the local abortion fund of your choice, which you can find this website, or you can join the national one and just donate, or you can donate your time. You can help people.
If you know someone in a state in which a trigger law has gone into effect, establish a mode of communication through them with them through something like WhatsApp or any kind of secured VPN, and offer all the help you can. Right now is not a time to be silent. It's time to come together and help our communities and really be there for those in need and those affected, which honestly is all of us. By the stripping away of our rights.
It goes without saying, but I'll say anyway, this is a pro-feminist, pro-intersectional, pro-LGBTQ podcast
Absolutely.
through the virtue of all of our friends and family and ourselves as well. So, I mean, if you don't like that, this is probably not going to be your
You can fuck
podcast.
off.
You can leave,
I don't imagine there's
and
anyone
we're
that's.
really sorry that you won't get to hear our great content. That being said, back to our original podcast that's full of happiness and creepiness. Thanks.
Predetermined programming is coming back at you right now with a fiery influx of knowledge from two people that are sunburnt and mosquito bitten and are just coming back from the Yucatan. Maddie and Tuck are bringing you that hot, hot knowledge. Maddie, take it away.
For everyone that speaks Spanish.
Oh, you funny. And we back, everybody. Hope you missed us. We missed you. Hoy tenemos un episodio muy increíble para ti. ¿Por qué? Because we just came back from Mexico, and we're bursting at the seams with knowledge and bug bites and all sorts of like insect venom at the moment. Because who are we? We're ADD Storytelling, the podcast in which we explore the myths and legends of our time, the past, the present, and the future, in no particular order, and sometimes with less than perfect focus. My name is Tucker, and I'm joined, as always, by our beautiful, diaphanous, neurodivergent host, Mads.
All right. Yes, I'm Mads, or Maddie, I guess, either way. And we're back to the cheerfulness and the creepiness and the this has some, dead stuff. So if you don't like dead stuff,
You're in the wrong place.
you should go to a different episode.
The fuck out of here. ¿Qué onda, Maddie?
So
What you got for us today?
this episode is inspired by our visit to Chichen Itza last week. We just got back from our 1 year anniversary of our legal marriage. Though we still get to have our reception because it's been postponed for 2 years because of COVID at the end of July.
Yes,
so
Maddie,
wahoo.
Lay all the personal details out on the podcast. Yes, Maddie.
Also, though, that means it's been a little over a year that we've been doing this podcast. So it's almost like an anniversary episode in double ways.
Yeah, we talked about this while sipping mojitos on the beach. Sorry, y'all. We live that fancy podcaster life because of all the money we get from you. But,
we don't make any money on this.
But yeah, we can kind of timestamp this project by the second episode, the Kitsune episode. We recorded and announced the fact that we'd gotten married.
Right, yeah, that was our second episode. If you don't know, Chichen Itza is an archaeological site in the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico, and it's an ancient site of the Maya civilization, though it was actually abandoned before the Spanish took over, which is interesting.
Abandoned, but never fully...
Like, people don't live there anymore, that kind of thing.
Because, like, people still lived around it.
Yeah, it's still a religious site. And a cultural site that people pilgrimage to, but they didn't live there anymore after, like, 1250.
Unlike places like, say, Machu Picchu, it's not, it was never, quote-unquote, lost. Like, the local people of the Yucatan, the Mayan community, always knew.
Yeah, 100%. They never forgot it was there. There's going to be some references to the classic period and the post-classic period of the Maya civilization, and that's... Between the classic period is the common era, 250 to 900, and post-classic period is CE 900 to 1524.
Essentially ending when the Spanish arrived.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This episode has a lot of sources because I actually did a lot of research, shocker.
That's a weird flex, because it almost makes it sound like the other ones weren't researched. But I know they were, audience. Just an interesting addendum.
Yeah, I guess it does say that I research a lot. I do a lot of reading.
Yeah, I don't know why you said
that.
I don't know.
I'm a reader. It's a thing. Anyway.
It's probably because they're on vacation right now. And they just have more time to just... I think all day you've been kind of ingesting this information.
Yeah.
And so you feel more empowered.
Totally.
Plus the, you know, the fact that we were just there.
We were just there.
That would help.
So. Sources, Chichen Itza.com.
Great.
Popol Vuh, a retelling by Ilan Stevans.
Which was really fun, considering our Popol Vuh episode, to go and experience.
We didn't do the whole Popol Vuh. We only did a part, the story of the Mayan hero twins.
The twins, yeah.
Which is like part of book one and all of book two of Xibalba. In the Popol Vuh. And I did use that same book again for all the quotes in this episode. And you should do that book because it's a great retelling.
Also listen to someone of the episode about the hero twins for some back context.
Yeah, season one, episode 6.
Wow.
I looked it up earlier. Yeah. Anywhoozles. The other one was New Perspectives on Human Sacrifice and Ritual Body Treatments in the Ancient Maya Society. Edited by Vera Teisler and Andrea Cucina.
I'm sorry, I just became extremely aroused by the title of that book.
And the article specifically that I drew on, Skeleton, Skulls, and Bones in the Art of Chichen Itza by Virginia Miller. There's also A Mathematical Journey Through the Land of the Maya by Philip Scalisi and Paul Fairbanks. Mesoamerican Mythology by K. Elmer Reed and Jason G. Gonzalez. And Classic Maya Bloodletting and the Cultural Evolution of Religious Rituals, Quantifying Patterns of Variation in Hieroglyphic Texts by Jessica Munson, Vivia Amati, Mark Collard, and Martha G. Macri. Wow.
You just took me from 6 to noon, and I am ready for this.
So, in case those titles didn't give it away, there's some stuff about, like, skulls and bloodletting and death.
Why are you
stuff.
So worried about the audience's ability to take that information?
I'm just saying, like, up top, that's going to be in there, but there's also other stuff. I wanted to give a little bit of background on what we know about the historical quantifying stuff of the Maya civilization in writing, specifically.
Basically nothing because of white people. Sorry, white person named Delanda.
In the classic period, a number of city-states that were also religious centers emerged, first in the forests of the Chiapas and the Guatemalan Pitan, and later in the Yucatan Plains. Maya country is found in present-day Chiapas, Tabasco, Campeche, Yucatan, and Quintana Roo in Mexico. Guatemala, parts of Belize, Honduras, and El Salvador. There were also invasions of Nahuatl-speaking groups around CE 400, between CE 700 and 900, and by the Aztecs in the post-classic period.
Yeah, there is some conjecture that the Toltec people were running Chichen Itza for a brief period of time during this age.
Apparently, the Aztecs first demanded tribute from the Quiche in 1501, and in 1510, they began paying tribute to Montezuma in quetzal feathers, gold, gems, beans, cloth, etc. Montezuma sent an emissary to the Quiche in 1512 to warn them about the Spanish, and they continued to pay tribute to the Aztec Empire until it fell in 1521.
I'm sorry, no, this is not important. Did you say an emissary?
Yes.
Emissary.
Emissary, sorry.
Don't mean to mansplain.
I've never said that. I've never said that word before.
Yeah.
The Quiche is another word for the Maya people.
What is?
Quiche.
Quiche. Oh, right. Yeah.
Early in the first millennium CE, the Maya developed a hieroglyphic phonetic script, which they used to record text and inscriptions on accordion-folded bark paper and deerskin coated with lime plaster and on finely painted pottery vessels of wood and reliefs of stucco and stone.
Generally, not dissimilar to like Greek and Northern African cultures.
Yeah, so they had books.
Yeah.
And then much of the Mayan texts were richly burned and stamped out by the conquistadors. In his capacity as the Franciscan provincial in the Yucatan, Father Diego de Landa, there you go, oversaw an inquisition in the city of Mani that culminated on July 11th, 1562, with the burning of dozens of Mayan codexes and thousands of images in auto de fe.
My sweet, dearest, loved wife.
Yes.
Do you mind if I step in here for a brief moment?
Sure, go ahead, say something. Did you learn something that you would like to share?
Because I was curious about Mayan culture and looking up books about Mayan mythology and folklore, and everything I found had the name Diego de Landa attached to it. My initial thought was, oh, cool, this is like a local Mexican anthropologist, historian.
No.
Diego de Landa was specifically told by the king and queen of Spain that their inquisition did not apply to indigenous peoples in their colonies because specifically they do not have the understanding to have been baptized and therefore do not understand the error of their ways. So to torture and persecute them is off the table. Delanda heard that and said, but I kind of want to.
In his Relación de las Cosas de Yucatán, Landa wrote, quoting, "These people also make use of certain characters or letters with which they wrote in their books their ancient matters and their sciences, and by these and by drawings and by certain signs in these drawings, they understood their affairs and made others understand and taught them. We found a large number of these books in these characters, and as they contained nothing in which there was not to be seen superstition and lies of the devil, we burned them all, which they regretted to an amazing degree and which caused them great affliction."
Yes. So,
it doesn't sound Delanda, so charming.
No, he's an absolute fucking monster.
I was being sarcastic.
I know you were. He mentioned that, like, this was part of his process. He would incorporate himself into the cultures that they were colonizing, learn all about their beliefs in order to effectively gut them from within. So, he went into the Yucatan, learned everything he possibly could about the Mayan theology and their religion, their folklore, and their belief system in order to destroy them. He is the reason why we only have 4 texts. The reason why I learned about Delanda is because he decided to make his penance. He realized the error of his ways. He was so sad that he'd done this, that he became the ultimate historical chronologer of Mayan history, speaking with princes of the people he'd like displaced and killed. And he wrote all these texts.
Okay. So, yeah, he sucks, but he is quoted kind of often because, yeah, he wrote that penance thing. So, whatever. And he's quoted a few times later here. Only 4 incomplete pre-Columbian Mayan codexes, none from the Guatemalan Highlands, unfortunately, have survived. These 4 known codices are referred to as the Dresden, the Paris, the Madrid, and the Grolier. The Dresden Codex is considered to be the best preserved, most beautiful, and complete of the 4. It is kept in the Stadtarchiv of Dresden in Germany for some reason, and is made of a model paper and screen-folded into 39 sheets. It was made between 1000 and 1200 and is linked to the Yucatan Maya at the Chichen Itza. It's essentially an astronomy text, which includes tables dealing with eclipses and the planet Venus.
That's very important to them.
So, 2 great texts were written after the conquest, the Popol Vuh and the books of the Chilam Balam. In the 17th and 18th centuries, the Quiché learned to transcribe their own language in Latin script. Scholars believe the Popol Vuh derives from a pre-Columbian codex written in Maya hieroglyphics, which is now lost. The Popol Vuh describes the creation of the world, the tales of epics and heroes like the Hero Twins, the history of the Highland Maya, and its earliest and most comprehensive document of myths and noble lineages in a language native to the Americas, recording the history of Quiché kings until 1550.
And ruling class didn't want the commoners to be able to read and write.
Yeah, they wanted it was to a noble maintain their that hold. Wrote nobles, previous nobles that
exactly.
wrote
the Maddie, I just wanted to interject really quickly to show you a photo of the Ukrainian-born man that was... He came to prominence as the person that was able to decipher the Dresden Codex.
Okay.
Yes, his name was Yuri Nazarov, and this is the only known photo that I've ever found of him, and it's one of my favorites. Can you describe what you're seeing here, Maddie?
It looks to be a very angry European man holding a Siamese cat.
Is he not perfect?
I mean,
look at that expression.
So on the Instagram, Tucker's going to make you a visual guide of Chichen Itza because he's the best. Yay.
You heard it here.
So anyway, we're going to be focusing mainly today on Chichen Itza and its connections to other Maya civilization stuff and things like that. So the name Chichen means mouth of the well, and Itza refers to those who founded it. The Itzaes, water witches, around the year 435.
That chi is mouth.
Okay. Just said mouth. Okay. The city had different waves of indigenous settlers, but it was abandoned well before the Spanish came to mess stuff up, way back in 1250. However, its power as a religious pilgrimage center. What? When did the Spanish get there?
No, I said the Spanish couldn't even get to Chichen Itza when they arrived. The forest was too overrun.
Yeah. However, its power as a religious pilgrimage center lasted until the 16th century, and one could argue that it has remained a site of pilgrimage since then.
I mean, yeah, I would say that we just did that.
Yes, in the art sense, Chichen Itza is unique because of the sheer number of skulls and skeletal figures represented on a large scale and in public places, and is probably the first Mesoamerican city to create a permanent decorated structure for the display of human bones.
Really?
Isn't that interesting? So this is from that article by Miller. So like much of Aztec public art, Chichen's focus on heart removal, severed heads, skulls, bones, and skeletal supernaturals, rather than on name places or on persons on or particular events.
Sorry, skeletal supernaturals?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
I think it's referring to the fact that the skeletal warriors are not specific people, but they're, like, showing the ritual practice of the warriors as skeletons.
Oh, so, like, in Elden Ring, when you, like, summon kind of, like, a skeletal fighter.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just like that. New attitudes towards warfare, capture, and sacrificial practices may not have increased like the amount of ritual slaughter, right? But they probably developed in tandem with the Itza state.
Yeah, I mean, you
probably in the latter part of the 9th century.
Your propaganda fuels your action.
Yeah.
You know, like what you do and what you put out kind of dictates what you need to propagate the same message. You can't just like, you can't have like May be the month of, look at all these bodies we have stuck up on these pikes. Isn't that sick? Well, that's it. Not going to do that again for a while. No, once you fucking go there, you got to consistently go there.
Okay. So, Tucker, tell me, what was the biggest part of Chichen Itza? What's the big draw?
The big draw?
Yeah.
Probablemente el castillo.
Yeah, the giant pyramid. The castle, the castillo, the pyramid of Kukulcan.
Kukulcan, Quetzalcoatl.
So the Mayans continue to be badass by creating the light and shadow phenomenon that takes place on the northern staircase of the castle.
Did you write the script? I feel like you usually don't write scripts for yourself.
I do sometimes.
Yeah? I love it.
Usually I summarize other people's words.
Yeah.
But this
yeah.
time I wrote
know.
Some. With but interjections. I did a little bit of both, yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. It takes place on the northern staircase of the castle during the spring equinox. On the 21st of March and the autumn equinox of the 21st of September. Those vary, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
At about 3 o'clock in the afternoon on the days of the equinox, the sun projects 7 triangles of light onto the balustrade of the northeastern side of the castle. These begin to move up and down along the balustrade to form the silhouette of a serpent, descending to its head in March and ascending from its head in September. Which is super interesting. Also, they're all feathered serpents.
Wow, you hear that, Jurassic Park?
Pretty cool.
You're still wrong.
Kukulcan, the plume serpent, is a highly symbolic and complex character. His name is a metaphor for the whirlwind, a great creative power, hurricane, bringer of rain. As such, he is also a potent being in nature into which powerful rulers and shamans could transform themselves. Quetzalcoatl Kukulcan is generally credited with providing legitimacy to the post-classic dynasties, which you know, the key shakings, etc. So the building itself sits on a rectangular platform, 182 feet wide, has a height of 24 meters or 78 feet. And each side of the pyramid has a large staircase. Apparently there's 91 steps per side, giving us 365 steps, which is fun.
Is it fun?
Well, it's very astrological.
Or does it mean that they knew what the end of the world was happening, which was 2020? Or, sorry, 2012.
It was 2020, wasn't it?
In a way.
Stone balustrades flank each staircase, and at the base of each north staircase sits 2 colossal feathered serpent heads, effigies of the god Kukulcan.
Did you not just read that they were along every side?
Oh, sorry. Balustrades are on each staircase, but the 2 serpent heads are on the north staircase.
Gotcha.
Sorry
okay,
if
okay.
that was unclear. Also, you know what's interesting?
What?
There's a dramatic example of human bones inside the top of the inner castillo at Chichen Itza. So there's 2 rows of human femurs embedded into the back wall of the inner chamber with their ends protruding.
Hello, yes. I am the designer of your new homestead. Yes. Oh, I see you've got an IKEA loungewear. That's nice. Would you like some femurs along your ceiling?
So I heard something about, like, that there was ritual significance to the femur about, like, relating to your name and your identity.
Yes! Yes!
So people
yes.
kept the femurs often.
That's why I suggest it.
It's really cool.
Wait. Hey. Femur. I barely know her. I'm sorry, I'll go now. I'm only here for the weekend. I have many bone ossuaries to collect and construct. I'll be seeing you. I'm off to Florida.
There's another building inside that building that they built that building on top of.
But like, I believe that they built 3 structures over it, and the initial one was built over the cenote, which we learned in 2014 is actually
down. I have it here. You were so close. 2015.
Damn!
In 1997, universities of Minnesota and San Francisco conducted radar studies in the area that led to the discovery of a hidden cenote under the pyramid of El Castillo in 2015, the Institute of Geophysics of the National Autonomous University of Mexico conducted magnetic resonances.
Yeah, renaissance. Magnetic resonances. French births.
That allowed it to geographically represent the cenote 8 meters hidden under the pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
In 2017, the Gran Aquifero, my research team began explorations in nearby caves to discover an entrance to the body of water. However, it was blocked by stones that were probably placed there intentionally.
What?
It's believed that this cenote was kept hidden because it represented the center of the world.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So they got a secret cenote in there.
That is absolutely amazing. So cool. Speaking of cenotes in that area, though, this is the location where all the dinosaurs died. Presumably, as the theory goes, the asteroid that caused the mass extinction of the Paleolithic era occurred in the Yucatan in the Gulf of Mexico. And that's why around Chichen Itza, there are numerous cenotes, which are actually, if you map them on a grid, they create an arc.
Where'd you learn that again? A sign?
I read it.
On a sign?
On a sign?
Like at the ruins?
Yes.
Cool. Another fun thing when we were there, other than the fact that it's amazing, was that a lot of groups of tourists were clapping in the front, like, courtyard area of the Castillo, and they were, you could hear, like, this weird acoustic sound that reminded me of those, like, big, if you ever had, like, someone, like, do a blast of air in your face with those weird, like, slingshot things.
Wow, that's what you got from it?
That's the sound I heard a bunch, but apparently it's supposed to sound like a bird.
I was reminded of those literal, the clapper tools, like those little plastic things that you would like kind of wave in your hand back and forth that would make clapping sound.
I didn't hear like a clapping. It was kind of like that, but it had like more of it behind it. It was like a longer sound to me.
It does seem that the Mayans were absolute masters in acoustics.
Yeah. Okay. My favorite part of the place that we went was the observatory. They call it the Caracol or the snail or the observatory. So it's one of...
And they call it the snail because of the spiral staircase within it.
Yes. So it's one of the few circular structures built by the Mayans and is said to have been used for astronomical observations.
I have never seen anything like this in Mesopotamian architecture. But then once you get through the tree line and you see this, it's a domed circular tower.
Right. It kind of reminded me of the like the modern telescope buildings that we build these days.
Yes, absolutely.
Apparently it was designed for tracking the movements of the moon and planets. Initially built in CE 800, it was altered and added to over the centuries. The tower's interior is often described as a spiral, but in reality it is a series of concentric circles. The inner core consists of a spiral staircase, hence the snail, which leads to the upper level. There are three window slits in the sides. One points due south, a second towards the setting of the moon and the spring equinox, and the third points to the west towards the setting of the sun on both equinoxes and the summer solstice.
It's insane!
So, also, the Popol Vuh gives us some significance to the directions and the placements. And this is an excerpt from when the first pair of twins goes down to Xibalba.
For our listeners that may have not listened to the Hero Twins episode, what is Xibalba?
Xibalba is the underworld, and cenotes are considered to be entrances to other world, as well as caves in general. Anyway, it's the place that you go when you die, and it's also considered to be very connected to the living world. So, Of the pass, one was red, another black, a third was white, and a fourth yellow. Each path was an entrance to a different dimension. In one, Tal was short, in the second, day is night, in the third, summer is winter, and in the fourth, criminals are honorable.
Some real Doctor Strange multiverse of madness.
It's the belief of the K'iche people that the crossroads are extremely dangerous. Unseen powers become seen. Likewise, the cardinal directions are associated with colors. White with north, red with east, yellow with south, and black with west. Candles must be lit in these four points to delimit the corners of nature. So the Pope of Vu is instructing us on the significance of both the cardinal directions, which could be used in the archaeological placements of these windows and such, and also in the significance of the colors. So there's also some creepiness about the tower.
That tower was very, very creepy.
Very creepy. Secondary burials, probably sacrificial, are known from several complexes in the southern part of Chichen Itza. At least three caches containing human remains, all quite different, were excavated from the tower. Bones really? Of children and young adults were scattered throughout the field behind the stairway of the lower platform, along with nearly 6,000 conch shell beads, a handful of green stone beads, and a shattered sandstone disc. On the west side of the upper platform, however, a different pattern emerged. Containing cremated human remains were found a few centimeters below the floor without offerings, while the bones of at least 24 men, women, and children were placed between the outer platform and the masonry block dividing the upper portion of the stairway. It's O-L-L-A-S. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
Possibly. 14 of the crania had been arranged in rows, with a scattering of other bones as well as a deer jaw and vertebrae and shards of a single incense burner. Finally, in the dirt filled of the niche dividing the upper platform stairway, where a broken panel with inscriptions and a carved circular stone were found, fragments of human bone were scattered. A few shreds, pieces of two obsidian blades, and more than 90 greenstone beads were associated with the bones. These offerings were found in different building phases of the Karakol, the time period between each phase is unknown.
To be buried above ground and not in a cenote and sent to Chibalba meant that you were someone that had done a lot of good deeds for the culture and therefore didn't need to go through the trials of the afterworld.
Yeah. I feel like I read that on one of the plaques.
Yeah.
That sounds super familiar.
Well, no. Eli told us that at lunch.
Is that what that was?
Yeah.
Hmm.
So, these individuals
Eli is
that
our
were...
tour guide. Recommend him. He was good.
These
Eli's
individuals that were buried here on site must have been extremely important. Otherwise, they would have been sent to Chibalba.
Well, they said probably sacrificial for these ones, so could have been. That's a good segue to the Sompentili of Chichen Itza, the large rectangular platform full of skulls. So, apparently it's 60 meters by 12 meters wide, so that's 197 feet by 39 feet wide. And it's across the courtyard from the famous pyramid. So, these ruins show us that the religious leaders of Chichen Itza most likely practice human sacrifice for religious and military purposes. Awesome. Some quotes from the Pope of Vu regarding sacrifice and also the role of death in Mayan life. Among the wonders of Chibalba is its eternal mutability. Every time a traveler describes it, the place changes. To some, it is reminiscent of their own cities of origin. To others, it's like no place in the natural world. Upon hearing about it, several white-bearded men who preach Christendom tried to enter it without success. The only one to emerge lost his mind. In his last written testimony, he said the darkness of Chibalba is of such depth, it's like entreating the heart of heaven, heart of earth. In Chibalba, death is life. And in the Popol Vuh also, the hero twins use the technique of sacrifice and magic to trick the lords of Chibalba. Then they sacrifice themselves. One would die, inserting a dagger into his chest. Having been killed, he would immediately come back to life. Those present were incredulous. We have the ending of that one in our first episode, by the way. So back to episode 6 if you want to hear the end of that. So the Zhongpanli of Chichen Itza, or the Platform of Skulls, is dedicated to the dead. Similar platforms can be found in different Mayan archaeological sites. Chichen boasts one of the oldest Mayan Zhongpanlis. The people of Chichen Itza would pike their enemies' heads on long wooden beams on top of this platform. Interestingly, they also carved 3 rows of 2,400 skulls piked in bas-relief on the sides of the platform, which is great for our posterity, but it seems a little extra, like, for the time, to be honest.
Oh, dude, everything about this is extra. Like, there's no point in which this is, like, just kind of a subtle move.
The primary subject of the bas-relief is the row of skulls, but it also shows scenes of human sacrifice, eagles eating human hearts, and skeleton warriors with arrows and shields. Archaeologists have found buried figures of Chakmul on the Zhongpanli of Chichen Itza, along with skull offerings and a broken ring from the ball court.
Wait, Chakmul. Does that mean, like, thunder god rabbit? Because Mulil was the town of rabbits.
Spelled differently. M-O-O. It's probably just the god.
Damn it.
Among the objects deposited within the Zhongpanli were 2 skulls accompanied by burned jade and a broken pyrite disc. Many jaws and skulls, some burned, as well as burned arrowheads and other materials, were found
scattered about
near the thing and may have been originally associated with the skull rack. Although mandibles and ceramics were found on the Zhongpanli stairway, the relative dearth of crania within the platform itself suggests that if skulls were displayed there, they were then subsequently removed and perhaps ritually deposited elsewhere. So that's interesting. Writing about the highland Guatemala Maya, Las Casas noted that before being buried, the heads of sacrificial victims were displayed for a time on poles atop structures dedicated solely to this function. The number of mandibles found along the wall suggests that poles for skull display may also have been set up along it. So, they were on top of the platform and also around the platform, and also there was the bas-relief of the skulls. So there's just a bunch of stuff.
You know what? What's really hitting me right now is the inclusion of mandibles discovered. That implies that these heads were up there so long that their jaws literally fell to the ground.
Yes, yes, and yes, so, yes. Yeah, 100%. And they moved the crania elsewhere.
And dear listener, just so you have a sense of context, like, this is pretty much the equivalent of, yeah, having 300 rotting skulls right next to Vons or Safeway, wherever you're listening.
Well,
from.
Next to the ball pit. So.
Just like. The, wherever like your pyramid. Center, like McDonald's,
yeah,
like
it's
wherever
in the
your
plaza.
Center.
It's the main plaza.
Yeah.
It's right up in there.
I'm upset.
So the first and most prominent example of these stone skull platforms, the Great Skull Rack, is located.
The Great Skull Rack.
Yeah. Is located in the Aztec capital of.
Teotihuacan?
Thanks. And described by the early conquistadors. So, piking heads and blood sacrifice could have been practiced in Chichen Itza, but the representation recording of bloodletting rituals on public monuments sends powerful, if not conspicuous, messages about the status and role of classic Maya rulers and their progeny.
Yeah, it's a very Toltec practice.
Despite documented risks associated with bloodletting, ritual acts of blood sacrifice are traditionally regarded as a central duty for divine Maya kings. Current scholarship argues that these were necessary rites of passage that legitimized an individual's rights to rule in the classic Maya society.
Whoa. Okay, so, to recap.
Bloodletting was good for kings to say, I'm a king. Look, I cut my hand. Yay.
It's essentially like a way of like showing that you're a man.
A legitimate ruler that believes the Mayan practices, yeah.
Yeah.
Not only do they have the hidden cenote.
Cool.
They also have the sacred cenote, which we did not see. But
cenote sagrado.
Yes. Yeah. So, as part of the offerings to the water god, The pre-Hispanic Maya made ceremonial offerings by throwing precious objects into the cenote.
Jade, obsidian, iPhones, Bitcoin.
Later, they introduced the practice of making human sacrifices. Those sacrificed were warriors, children, and maidens thrown into the bottom of the cenote.
Aww.
To one side of that south bank of the well, they built some platforms on two levels, which perhaps were used as seats for those who witnessed the ceremonies. Besides this, one can see the ruins of a building that was adapted into a steam bath.
Oh, sweet. So you could just like...
where people were purified before the sacrifice.
Yeah. Oh, or...
Yeah, and then there's also another platform that hangs over the edge, which you could use to throw things in the stuff.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Love that.
The Sacred Cenote still holds unbelievable stories. In 1998, it became a patrimony of humanity by UNESCO. And even if the Pyramid of Kukulkan is the most famous building in the site, it's connected to the Sacred Cenote by a 300-meter road.
Within the culture, the cenotes themselves are entrances to Xibalba or the underworld, and some members of the society believed that they would gain prescience or the ability to see fortuitous events that would unfold if they were to enter and come out from the cenotes.
The cenote has been through different restorations over the years. The first interventions were led by Edward H. Thompson,
yeah,
then the U.S. Consul in Progreso, who was financed by the Harvard University's Peabody Museum and private collectors from the Boston area.
They he dredged the whole thing and just took out all the treasure.
They
fucked
it up. As a result, in 1904, the U.S. took many jade and gold pieces from the site and took them out of the country illegally.
Fuck!
It wasn't until 1914 when the violence of the Mexican Revolution unintentionally put an end to the looting of Chichen Itza.
What? Unintentionally? Really?
I think they meant by that the Mexican Revolution happened and had that effect, but it wasn't, that wasn't the point
wasn't
of the revolution.
That wasn't the goal of the revolution. Yeah. Yes, I understand. Okay.
So, to this day, over 200 bodies, jewels, and ceramics and gold pieces have been found as part of the archaeological findings of the cenote.
It's true. And Maddie and I actually swam in it and had a really good time just kind of wading around. I kicked a bunch of femurs. It was lovely.
You're just making this up.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Nice time. We got...
it's not good for swimming.
No. In that it's a...
it's full of plants.
Full of plants and also people, Maddie.
Yeah, but on the website it says it's not good for swimming. There's a lot of plants.
Okay, but I think people take precedence over plants.
Okay. The depositions in the cenote are well known, but in any case, they may not always have been involved in the sacrifice of living victims, as has commonly been assumed. What distinguishes the cenote from burials and caches, however, is the long period of time during which it served as a repository for sacrificial and other offerings, and the great variety of materials that were found commingled with human remains. These ranges of objects of valuable materials, so jade, gold, obsidian, ceramics, carved wooden shell, cloth, copal, rubber,
right?
Probably copper, to the mundane or merely puzzling, baskets, flaked chert implements, wooden tools, sea fans and shark teeth, animal and bird bones, knives with serpents carved in wood as handle and others with gold-covered handles may have been broken and tossed in the cenote on completion of a sacrifice. One was found to have copal and red pigment along its edges.
Vapes, Bitcoin, and Pokemon cards also discovered.
The fluid environment of the cenote and its difficulties in dredging it without disturbing the original location of the contents have made it impossible to determine the relationship of human remains to other types of offerings.
Oh, but those whitey boys really, they give it their all. They fucked it up real good.
Right. This is one part of the sacrifice, right? There's like, so far we've had sacrifice of your enemies on the skull platform.
Mm.
You buy, you know.
And that's on the top of the pyramid.
No, the skull platform is the zompenti.
Oh, right. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There is things that, there, like, was a remain where, like, they killed someone on the top of the pyramid and its head fell down the steps.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
That's my favorite.
Also, there's heart sacrifice depicted in murals on the Temple of Warriors and the Upper Temple of the Jaguars, and also on a gold plaque in the cenote.
Did we see the Temple of the Jaguar?
I don't know.
I mean, Temple of the Warriors. I think we saw the Temple of the Warriors. Favorite. Yeah, no, absolutely.
The figures with skeletal attributes represented at Chichen Itza, though, do not occur in these scenes and are not victims, but rather living impersonators or supernaturals.
Impersonators?
Yeah.
Is a fun inflection.
Impersonators. Sorry. Ba 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 ba. With all these human remains and such, the demographic structure of them rejects the authenticity of the myth of female sacrifice being, like, female versions being thrown into the pit exclusively. The skeletal sample pertains to individuals of both sexes and all age groups. The majority of the remains belong to sub-adults, and among the adult segment, to young males.
So sub-adults, dissimilar than dom-adult.
Yeah, correct? Totally.
Yes.
Despite the damage that the material suffered during the recovery process, they were able to reconstruct different scenarios that might have occurred at the edge of the cenote.
Really? So they were able to understand, like, the processes that went into the actions?
Well, this is all of great debate, but, like, this, okay. Yeah, that author was able to reconstruct different scenarios that might have happened. So he promotes the idea of dismembered corpses thrown into the sinkhole, taking into account the cut and stab marks encountered on some of the remains. The majority of the remaining pieces do not present specific signs of violence. Additionally, several bilateral bony segments could be paired, likely indicating that whole bodies were deposited in the cenote.
This also kind of implies that in Mayan culture, death was not seen as a bad thing, but just a continuation of life into another realm.
Indeed.
Wherein...
And there was, like, a huge set of rules for every ritual killing that basically everyone had to follow, and it was taken out by, like, usually, like... by religious and cultural leaders that had to follow the same, like, precedents.
Yes. From what these investigators are turning up, these people weren't struggling or fighting back, necessarily.
Well, unfortunately, I wasn't able to read that entire paper because I didn't have access to the whole book. It's like...
Pay the $5, Maddie.
It was $115.
God damn, Maddie, just pay it. What are you doing?
So I didn't get to read that article, though it sounded like the most interesting one. I was referring to the summary of that article from the introduction, which is really interesting.
Counterpoint to my own statement, though. Like, if you're going to be stepped through the heart, that's a quick one. And that'll really incapacitate you.
Like the pretty fast. Stabbed in the heart.
Yeah.
And you're to blame.
I'm not going to comment on that.
Okay. So this giant platform of skulls that we referred to earlier is right next to the ball game pit, which kind of resembled a modern
stadium. Love that ball game pit.
The ball game pit.
Ball pit.
It's pretty huge. It's got a temple on the top of one side. It's got a temple at the end of a field. It's got rings. What they played in the stadium, we don't know necessarily, but
Fortnite.
It's been possible to partially reconstruct the rules of the game, thanks to pictorial representations and stone monuments. We know that at the beginning of the game, the ball was thrown into the court by hand, and that from the moment it hit the ground, it can only be touched with hips and thighs. No hands. We do not know the number of players, the scoring system, or how the winner was decided. According to information in the Popol Vuh, we can infer that the game could be played one-on-one, in pairs, or in teams.
Do you imagine how sexy that would be, though? It's all hips. It's all hips and nips.
When the Hero Twins,
it's all thighs and gyration.
When the Hero Twins in the Popol Vuh, when they were summoned to play ball in Xibalba with the Lords of Death,
yeah.
It says, in 7 days, they must come to play ball with us. Mm. Let them bring their playing tools, the rubber ball, the yokis,
okay, so
the gloves, and the leather to be competitive.
Once again, I mean, I know we've covered this in the Hero Twins episode, but so it's a rubber ball made from the rubber of tree.
A rubber ball.
Okay.
I have a thing about the rubber ball right after this quote.
Okay.
So, a scene from the ball court. We shall use our rubber ball, the Lords of Xibalba said. No, the twins responded, we'll use ours. We refuse, the Dark Lord declared. Fine. As ended that argument. The Lords of Xibalba threw the ball directly into Wanapu's ring. and as soon as they took hold of the knives of stone to tear the twins to pieces, the ball started to bounce along the entire ball court.
So this would be obsidian sacrificial knives.
Mm-hmm. So, the lords tend to cheat a little bit at the ball game.
Astounding setting foot in that court.
It is long. And the hoops were really high up. I felt like it was higher than a basketball hoop.
Fucking, yeah, way up there.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes sense.
They have little Ouroboros snakes on them.
Yes. It was the first person to score a goal that would be the winner.
Well, I don't know. In the Popol Vuh, you could score more than one.
Really? Okay. I heard while at the site that it was the first one to get the rubber ball through.
I think we don't know. I think there's debate.
That's probably likely.
I think there's debate on how it was played.
Also, the winning captain is the one that's killed. So it's also like, where's the motivation? You heard the opposite?
I heard that the captain's the only one that lives and everyone else dies.
I heard the captain's the one that dies.
Oh, see, well, we even heard totally different things when we were at the same place. The ball for the game was made from liquid latex extracted from rubber trees. When heated, the resin formed threads that were first rolled up and then squeezed by hand or pressed into a mold. The weight of the ball varied between 3 and 5 kilos, and when it became deformed, it had to be stretched back into shape. Each player had his own ball as part of his personal equipment. In the depictions, there are some balls small enough to fit in the hand, like a softball, and others were bigger than a soccer ball.
Well, I mean, if you just look at the size of the opening in the hoop, like, it couldn't be any bigger than the hole.
Right, so a soccer ball could definitely fit in there, and also a softball could also fit, being smaller.
Isn't a soccer ball gonna fit through that?
Yeah.
Huh.
I think a basketball could have.
Hmm.
Also, the first set of twins that went to Shubaba were sacrificed and buried in Pukbal, which is a word that refers to the dust that becomes visible during an intense game in the ball pit.
Oh.
And the head of one of the twins was cut off, and the rest of his body was buried with the younger brother, right? But that one is the one that turns into the head of the calabash tree that later gives birth to the other hero twins.
It's also something to be said here about the significance of the hoop. The shape of the square refers to the 4 cardinal points as well as the 4 limbs of the human body, and therefore the corporeal realm in which we all live. Whereas the circle, you can think about the observatory, is a holy shape. And which also extends into why they didn't ever impart wheels on any kind of transportation vessels or like carts, because they felt that that would be an affront to the spiritual realm in which the circle is holy. So the fact that the hoops were actually circular is of intense importance.
Well, that's a conjecture you're making.
It is absolutely conjecture.
Also, this is a direct quote from our tour guide, Eli Mendez. So.
I'm extrapolating from tour guide, but yeah.
Without the extrapolation, everything else was from him.
Would you not agree, though?
If I was going to make a conjecture.
Yes.
I would say that the whole ball game is a ritual and sacrificial practice towards the higher realm, and therefore the ball is round and the hoop is round. It's because you're connecting to the god.
Yes.
So.
That's what I'm getting at.
So that's the creepy tour of Chichen Itza. I recommend seeing all of it. It was freaking beautiful. And life-changing. Life-changing to see.
Truly. And we barely covered.
There's so much more.
Half of
that
what
we didn't
learned.
Cover. Yeah. I was wondering if you want to hear more about the bones.
The bones,
yeah,
yes.
I have a thing about bones here.
Yes, give me all your bones.
So, final fun fact. The Itza people did not limit themselves to merely representing bones and skulls in art. Human bones were reworked and manipulated into a great variety of ways, ranging from incense burners, probably from the skull or the femur, or carving them into shapes of turkeys and birds of prey. Also, it could be argued that the skull incense burners from cenotes were fashioned from the heads of important ancestors rather than sacrificial victims. So crania and long bones were especially potent heirlooms for the ancient Maya, and are the bones most often missing from incomplete elite burials. Even today, skulls are venerated by the Itza of northern Guatemala. You know, Shithead Landa also described how victorious warriors removed the jawbones from the defeated dead, cleaned the flesh off, and wore them on their arms as bracelets. Incised bone bracelets, probably carved from a human cranium, were found on the upper arms of an important individual buried at Ixmiche. That's really blurred, so it's hard to...
Perfect. Well, Ixmiche. Thank you, Maddie. This is exactly how I wanted to end this episode. Wearing people's bones.
Yeah, it's really cool.
And thank you, dear listener, for once again joining us. Words can't describe how much it means to us that you've stuck with us this whole time. And
thanks for joining us on our anniversary episode. Follow us on Instagram at
ADD Storytelling Podcast,
where Tucker is going to give you some cool Chichen Itza images that he took with his fancy camera. And also, you can follow us on TikTok at ADD_
You got it.
Storytelling?
Just ADD Storytelling, yeah.
With the underscore.
Uh-huh.
And then you can support our podcast at anchor.fm/ADD Storyteller. You can email us at addstoryteller@gmail.com if you've got cool Mayan myths that you want to send to us, or any other cool bone-related interesting things, archaeological in nature. That would be cool. Give us your feedback whenever you like, and thanks for joining us.
Awesome. And I'm going to start a new tradition here. Maddie, close us out with your best impersonation of a jaguar.
No.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.